A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. And I have to say, it's a prompt that starts in a storage closet and ends up asking one of those questions that sounds simple but isn't. He's been labeling inventory with paint markers, scrawling IDs on pricing devices, and it got him thinking about the gap between everyday utilitarian writing and calligraphy as a craft tradition. And then he asks, where's the spiritual home of calligraphy? Is it Japan? Or does that title belong somewhere else? He wants us to trace the whole lineage. Chinese origins, Japanese Shodo, Korean Soai, Islamic calligraphy, Western traditions, Hebrew Soferet. And then actually answer the question. Not just admire everyone's brushwork and call it a day.
Which is the right way to ask it, because Spiritual Home is doing a lot of work here. It's not who did it first, and it's not who does it best. It's something closer to, where does calligraphy sit at the center of the culture rather than at the edge?
And if you just look at chronology, the conversation ends in about 12 seconds.
The oracle bones alone push Chinese writing back to around 1200 BCE. These are ox scapulae and turtle plastrons with questions carved into them, divination texts. And you can already see, even at that stage, that the act of inscription matters. These aren't just scratch marks, there's attention to how the characters sit on the bone. The Shang Dynasty diviners were making aesthetic choices.
Which is wild to think about. Someone in 1300 BCE is carving a question about tomorrow's harvest into a turtle shell, and they care about how it looks.
Then the standardization under the Qin Dynasty, Qin Shi Huang unified the script around 221 BCE. This is the small seal script, and it's a political act as much as an aesthetic one. You can't run an empire if every region writes differently, but the standardization also created a canonical form that later calligraphers could push against. You need a rule before you can break it.
The jazz principle of calligraphy.
And then the Han Dynasty gives us clerical script, Li Shu, which is more practical, faster to write, and it's where you start seeing the brush really take over from the stylus. The Tang Dynasty, 7th to 10th centuries, is often called the Golden Age. You get Yan Zhenqing, you get Lu Gongquan, you get the models that every calligraphy student in East Asia would copy for the next 1200 years.
This is where we need to name something that's easy to miss if you didn't grow up in the tradition. In China, calligraphy wasn't a decorative art off to the side. It was the highest of the arts. Above poetry, although the three were intertwined. Your calligraphy was read as a direct expression of your character. A Tang Dynasty civil service exam didn't just test what you wrote, it tested how you wrote it.
The concept is, the brush traces the heart. And this is not metaphor. They genuinely believed, and this persists, that you cannot hide who you are in your brushwork. A shaky hand betrays a shaky soul. The strokes don't lie.
Which raises the stakes considerably when you're labeling inventory with a paint marker.
The paint marker is the great democratizer of shame. Everyone's handwriting looks bad on corrugated cardboard.
China establishes the foundation. Oracle bones to seal script to clerical to regular script, kaishu, and then the more expressive running script and cursive script, the full toolbox. And then Buddhism carries it east.
The transmission to Japan happens in waves, but the big one is the 6th and 7th centuries, via Korean scribes initially, and then directly from China. Buddhist sutras needed to be copied, and copying sutras was a meritorious act. You gained spiritual merit by the act of transcription itself. So from the very beginning, Japanese calligraphy has this devotional dimension.
Here's where it gets interesting. Japan doesn't just import Chinese calligraphy and keep doing it the Chinese way. They develop kana.
Kana is the big fork in the road. Chinese characters, kanji, are logographic. Each character represents a word or a morpheme. Japanese is a completely different language family with a completely different grammatical structure. You can't just write Japanese using only Chinese characters without serious contortions. So over centuries, they developed the kana syllabaries, hiragana and katakana, by simplifying and abstracting Chinese characters. And this creates an entirely new aesthetic possibility.
The flowing cursive hiragana, especially women's hand on a day, becomes associated with Japanese literature. The Tale of Genji was written in hiragana. The great women writers of the Heian period are writing in this script that curves and flows in ways that Chinese characters don't.
It's worth noting, Chinese calligraphy, for all its expressive range, is still working with characters that are fundamentally blocky in conception. There's a squareness to them even in cursive. Hiragana is all curves and connections. It breathes differently.
Japan takes the Chinese tradition and adds a whole new instrument to the orchestra. But then they go further. They develop a philosophical framework around it that's distinct.
This is where Zen comes in. And I want to be careful here because the popular Western understanding of Zen calligraphy is often pretty shallow. It's not just about being spontaneous and free. The discipline is ferocious. A Zen calligrapher might spend decades copying models before they're permitted to express anything personal. The spontaneity is earned.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I'm not sure that...
You don't just grab it. You spend years earning its trust, and then one day it sits on your lap and you pretend it was always your idea.
Actually, not a terrible analogy for the relationship between discipline and spontaneity in Shodo. The outward result looks effortless. The inward preparation is anything but.
Then there's the material culture. This is where the Japan argument gets really strong. We're not just talking about the act of writing. We're talking about everything that surrounds it.
Handmade, often from kozo or gampai fibers. Sumi ink sticks that you grind yourself on a suzuri stone. The act of preparing the ink is part of the practice. Feud brushes made from specific animal hairs for specific purposes. The entire material ecosystem is treated with reverence.
It cascades down into everyday life in a way that doesn't happen elsewhere. Japan has a stationery industry that treats writing instruments with a level of seriousness that borders on the religious. Pilot, Sailor, Platinum with their fountain pens, Tombow and Mitsubishi with their pencils, Kuretake with their brush pens, Zebra with everything. These are companies that do research and development on how ink flows through a nib at a level of precision that most countries reserve for aerospace engineering.
There's a reason why someone in Dublin or Des Moines who gets into fountain pens will end up, within about 6 months, owning a Pilot Custom 812 or a Sailor Pro Gear. The Japanese manufacturers dominate the high end of the writing instrument market globally because they treat it as a serious craft.
This is the spiritual home argument for Japan. It's not just that they have great calligraphers. Every tradition has great calligraphers. It's that the entire culture seems to have decided that writing, and the tools of writing, deserve a level of attention and care that elevates them beyond mere utility. The wabi-sabi aesthetic, the beauty of imperfection, of transience, runs through the whole thing. A slightly irregular brushstroke isn't a mistake. It's evidence of the human hand.
That aesthetic has downstream effects. The lo-fi hip-hop study girl with her Muji notebook and her pastel highlighters, that's not unrelated to Shodo. It's a distant descendant, stripped of the Zen metaphysics, but retaining the core idea that the act of writing things down is inherently valuable and the tools should be beautiful.
The lo-fi girl is the Wang Shiji of the 21st century.
That's going to need some unpacking.
Wang Shiji, 4th century, often called the greatest calligrapher in Chinese history. His most famous work, The Preface to the Orchid Pavilion, was composed during a drinking party. The story goes that he tried to recreate it later, sober, and couldn't. The spontaneity was the point. The lo-fi girl is curating her own version of that. The perfect study environment, the right pen, the right notebook, to achieve a state of focused flow. The metaphysics are gone, but the impulse is the same.
Okay, I'll grant that the comparison is less absurd than it first sounded, but it also points to something important. The Japan argument has a popular culture dimension that the other traditions don't. Chinese calligraphy is ancient and revered, but it doesn't have the same global consumer-facing presence. Islamic calligraphy is arguably more central to its civilization, but it's less accessible to outsiders because of the language barrier and the religious context.
Let's go there. Because if we're talking about spiritual home, in the sense of theological centrality, this is the heavyweight contender.
It's not even close. In Islam, the prohibition on figurative religious imagery. And I should note this varies by period and region. It's not an absolute rule across all of Islamic history. But the broad effect was that calligraphy became the primary visual art of the faith. You walk into a mosque, you're not seeing paintings of prophets, you're seeing text. The word of God rendered in the most beautiful form human hands can manage.
The medium is literally the message. The Quran is the direct word of God in Islamic theology, so rendering that word beautifully is an act of devotion. It's not decoration, it's worship.
The diversity of scripts is staggering. Kufic, angular, geometric, monumental, used for architecture for the earliest Quran manuscripts. Then Nasq, more cursive, more readable, becomes the standard for copying the Quran. Thuluth, tall, elegant, the script of mosque interiors and titles. Diwani, developed in the Ottoman chancery, incredibly ornate, almost deliberately illegible to outsiders, which was part of the point for official documents.
The Ottomans take this to an extraordinary level. The great calligraphers, Sheikh Hamdullah, Hafiz Osman, Mustafa Rakim, are national treasures. The sultans studied calligraphy. The tools are treated with reverence. The reed pen, the ink, the paper, the makta, the little rest for the pen. There's a whole material culture here too.
The ijaza system, the license to practice and teach. Calligraphy was transmitted through chains of master to student that could be traced back for centuries. Your calligraphic lineage mattered. It's the Isnad system applied to art.
Which is similar to how Zen calligraphy lineages work in Japan, actually. The stamp of the master. But in Islam, the stakes are higher because you're transmitting the word of God. A mistake in a Quran manuscript isn't just an aesthetic failure, it's potentially a theological one.
Which is why the rules are so strict. The proportions of each letter are defined relative to the dot, the nukta, made by a single dip of the reed pen. The alif, the vertical stroke, is a specific number of dots high depending on the script. Everything is measured. The freedom comes within that measurement.
If we're ranking by theological centrality, Islamic calligraphy wins. It's not even a contest. Chinese calligraphy is the highest of the arts. Japanese calligraphy is a path to spiritual development. Islamic calligraphy is the visual embodiment of revelation.
Yet, and I think this is where the question gets really interesting, spiritual home might mean something different. It might mean, where does the spirit of calligraphy most fully infuse the culture, from the highest art to the most everyday practice?
On that measure, Japan has a strong case. The person in Tokyo writing a New Year's card in brush pen is participating in a continuum that runs back through the Zen masters to the Heian court to the Chinese sages. The stationery store is the temple of the everyday sacred.
Let me push back on that a little because I think we're at risk of romanticizing Japan in a way that flattens other traditions. The person in Cairo writing a shop sign in Nasq is also participating in a continuum. Islamic calligraphy isn't just in mosques and manuscripts. It's on street signs, it's on currency, it's on everyday objects. The difference is that it's so pervasive, it's almost invisible.
That's fair. And we should talk about the other traditions too, because they're not footnotes. Korean seoi, Korean calligraphy, has its own history and its own aesthetic. Hangul, the Korean alphabet, was developed in the 15th century under King Sejong, and it's a designed writing system in a way that most scripts aren't. The shapes of the letters are based on the shape of the mouth when pronouncing them. It's a feat of phonetic engineering that also happens to be beautiful.
Korean calligraphers work in both Hanja, Chinese characters, and Hangul. The Hangul calligraphy tradition has a geometric clarity that's distinct from both Chinese and Japanese styles. It's underappreciated globally, partly because Korea hasn't exported its calligraphy culture the way Japan has.
Then there's the Western tradition, which is a completely different animal. Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Islamic calligraphy all use the broad-edged pen or the brush. The line width varies with the angle and pressure. Western calligraphy, and I'm thinking of the broad-edged pen traditions here, has its own logic.
The medieval European scriptoria. Monks copying manuscripts, developing the hands that would define Western writing for a millennium. Carolingian minuscule in the 8th and 9th centuries. This is the script that Charlemagne's court standardized, and it's the basis for our lowercase letters today. Clear, legible, revolutionary.
Then Gothic blackletter, which is the script everyone pictures when they think medieval manuscript. Dense, angular, vertical. Beautiful but slow to write, and sometimes hard to read. The tension between legibility and beauty runs through the whole Western tradition.
The Italian Renaissance gives us italic, faster, more flowing, the first Western script that really prioritizes speed without sacrificing elegance. And then the pointed pen takes over. Copperplate in the 18th century, all those hairlines and swells created by pressure on a flexible nib. Spencerian in the 19th century, the script of American business, the script of the Coca-Cola logo.
Here's the thing about Western calligraphy. It was never the highest of the arts. It was never theologically central. It was a craft, and a highly respected one, but it didn't carry the metaphysical weight that calligraphy carries in East Asia or the Islamic world. The Renaissance elevated painting and sculpture. Calligraphy was beautiful writing, but it was just writing.
Which is why, when the printing press arrived, Western calligraphy declined. It became a specialty skill rather than a cultural foundation. In China, printing existed for centuries alongside calligraphy and never displaced it as the highest form of writing. In Europe, Gutenberg more or less ended the scriptorium.
Then there's Hebrew Sofrut, which is its own universe.
Sofrut is the religious scribal tradition in Judaism, and it's governed by halakha, Jewish law, in exhaustive detail. The sofer, the scribe, writes Torah, scrolls, mezuzo, tefillin. Every letter must be formed precisely. If a single letter is malformed or touching another letter incorrectly, the entire scroll can be invalidated.
The stakes are cosmic. A Torah scroll that's missing a letter or has an extra letter. The traditional understanding is that this affects the spiritual structure of the universe. The sofer isn't making art. The sofer is performing an act of cosmic maintenance.
The rules are staggering. The parchment must be from a kosher animal. The ink must be black, made from specific ingredients. The quill, the colmus, is traditionally a turkey feather or a reed. The sofer must pronounce each word aloud before writing it. The letters must be written in order. You can't go back and fill in a missing letter later.
There's a passage in the Talmud, in Tractate Meneshut, that describes how Rabbi Ishmael once corrected a sofer's work and said, "Be careful in your work, for your work is the work of heaven." And then he lists the consequences of omitting or adding a single letter. You destroy the world, or you create a false world.
Yet, and this is what fascinates me, Sofrut is not, strictly speaking, calligraphy in the artistic sense. The sofer is not trying to be expressive. The sofer is trying to be accurate. The beauty emerges from the precision, but it's not the goal. It's a byproduct.
Which is almost the inverse of the Japanese approach, where the beauty and the expressiveness are the point, and the precision is in service of that.
The sofer would be horrified by the idea of expressive brushwork. The Zen calligrapher would find the sofer's constraints spiritually limiting, and both are producing work of extraordinary beauty. It's two completely different theories of what makes writing sacred.
Let's try to answer the question, is Japan the spiritual home of calligraphy?
I think the answer is, it depends on what you mean by spiritual home, and the fact that the question is even plausible tells you something important about Japan. The question is plausible because Japan has done something no other culture has done. It has taken a tradition it imported, Chinese calligraphy, and not just mastered it, but transformed it into something that permeates the entire culture, from the Zen temple to the stationary aisle at Tokyu Hands. And it has exported that culture globally. When a teenager in Brazil gets into calligraphy, they're probably buying Japanese brush pens and watching YouTube tutorials that reference Japanese aesthetics. The global imagination of calligraphy is disproportionately Japanese.
Yet the para tradition is Chinese. The invention, the foundational masters, the core scripts, that's China. If spiritual home means where the soul of the tradition was born, the answer is China, and it's not particularly close.
If spiritual home means where calligraphy is most central to the religious life of the civilization, the answer is the Islamic world. Calligraphy is the visual language of Islamic spirituality in a way that has no parallel in any other tradition.
If spiritual home means where the act of writing is most tightly bound to cosmic consequences, the answer might be the Jewish scribal tradition. The Sofer's quill is literally holding the universe together.
Japan doesn't win on primacy. It doesn't win on theological centrality. It doesn't win on metaphysical stakes. What it wins on is cultural saturation. The distance from the highest expression of the art to the most everyday writing implement is shorter in Japan than anywhere else.
The brush pen is the symbol of this. It's a marker. It's a disposable writing tool. But it has a flexible tip that mimics a brush, and Japanese schoolchildren use them for calligraphy practice, and adults use them for New Year's cards, and somehow this mass-produced plastic object is connected to a tradition that runs back through centuries of Zen masters to the Tang Dynasty. That's the Japan argument in a single object.
I think, if we're being honest, that's probably the answer the prompt is reaching for. Not Japan is objectively the spiritual home of calligraphy. That's too sweeping. But Japan has created the conditions where the spirit of calligraphy is most alive and accessible in everyday life.
Which brings us back to Daniel and his paint markers.
The gap between utilitarian writing and the craft tradition is real, and it's wide, and it's probably wider now than at any point in history. Most people type. Most people's handwriting is deteriorating. The act of writing by hand is becoming optional in a way it never was before.
Yet, people keep buying fountain pens. People keep watching calligraphy videos. The bullet journal community exists. The study tube aesthetic exists. There's a hunger for the physical act of making marks on paper that persists despite, or maybe because of, the digitization of everything else.
I think the paint marker on a pricing device is actually a perfect entry point to this whole question. It's the most utilitarian writing imaginable. You're labeling inventory. There's no pretense of beauty. And yet the moment you pick up the marker, you're making choices. How you form the letters, how you space them, whether you care about how they look. The impulse toward beautiful writing is latent even in the most mundane act of writing.
The gap isn't between calligraphy and everyday writing. The gap is between the attention we pay to everyday writing and the attention we could pay. The traditions we've been talking about, all of them, are traditions of attention. The sofa paying attention to each letter. The Zen calligrapher paying attention to each breath and each stroke. The Ottoman master paying attention to the proportions of the alif. The attention is the practice.
You can't pay that kind of attention to a pricing device label. You can't. The medium resists it. But you can notice that you can't, and that noticing is itself a small act of attention.
Here's my conclusion, and I think it's where we land. China is the birthplace. The Islamic world claims the theological summit. The Jewish tradition holds the metaphysical stakes. Japan is where calligraphy most fully escaped the temple and the palace and the scriptorium and moved into the stationery store. Japan democratized the sacred act of writing without entirely stripping it of its sacredness. The brush pen is a secularized ritual object. And that, I think, is what people are responding to when they feel that Japan is the spiritual home of calligraphy. It's not historically accurate, but it's emotionally accurate.
I'd add one thing. The spiritual home framing might be the wrong framing entirely. Maybe the right way to think about it is that calligraphy is a language, and each tradition is a dialect. They're mutually intelligible at the level of the impulse, the desire to make writing beautiful, to infuse marks on a surface with meaning beyond the semantic content. But each one has its own grammar, its own vocabulary, its own accent. Japan speaks one dialect, and it speaks it extraordinarily well, and it has made that dialect globally legible in a way that the other dialects aren't. But calling it the spiritual home is like calling New Orleans the spiritual home of music. It's true in a certain light, and it's deeply unfair to Vienna and Havana and Lagos and Delhi, and it's still a useful way to orient yourself.
Covering the covers.
And the thing about the paint marker is that it's asking the same question. All these traditions ask, just at a much lower resolution, what does it mean to make a mark that matters? What does it mean to write something down in a way that honors what you're writing? The sofer and the Zen master and the Ottoman calligrapher and the kid with the bullet journal are all, in their own ways, answering that question.
The kid with the bullet journal is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence.
The bullet journal is the Western esoteric tradition of calligraphy. It's not about the letter forms, it's about the system. The beauty is in the organization. It's calligraphy for people whose sacred texts are to-do lists.
Now I'm picturing a medieval monk illuminating a grocery list, We are out of eggs in gold leaf and lapis lazuli.
There is probably a Japanese stationery product for exactly that.
There absolutely is. It's called the Midori MD Notebook, and it costs $40, and it's worth every penny. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1880s, a German scholar cataloging Roman provincial records in Trier discovered a parchment fragment detailing road maintenance contracts for the Via Belgica. The document specifies that contractors were required to supply their own measuring rods, and that any rod found to be short by more than one Roman digit, about 18.5 millimeters, would result in the contractor being fined the cost of repaving the entire disputed segment.
The Romans invented the "you're paying for the whole job" penalty clause.
The ancient world was just as petty as we are. I find that deeply comforting. This has been My Weird Prompts, written and produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed the episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.